What keeps you going? Where do you get your motivation? Whether you just want to be the best you can be or the best there ever was, we're here to keep you inspired. Conversations with today's top fitness influencers, coaches, athletes, and bodybuilding professionals. This is Inspired Fitness. Here's your host, Sean Feuderer.
Welcome back to another episode of the Inspired Fitness Podcast. I'm joined today by my co-host, IFBB Pro, Kimberly Helm, along with our very special guest. He's creator of the Fit to Fat to Fit, Drew Manning. Drew, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure.
How is the beautiful island in Hawaii today?
It's beautiful, sunny, 80 degrees, pretty much typical weather for out here almost 90% of the year. So
I think I need to come spend some more time there.
Yeah, sure. I don't blame you. It is paradise for sure. But you do pay a price. It is expensive. I'll say that. So,
Drew, you've achieved a bit of fitness fame over the years, and you've created and put yourself through hell by gaining 60 or 70 pounds and then losing it with your clients. You're creating the Fit to Fat to Fit program. Could you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to do that and kind of what results you've seen over the years, maybe how you steer your clients a little bit? Just give us some background.
Yeah. So this all started back in 2011. A little bit of backstory. I grew up in a family of 11 brothers and sisters. So I was one of 11 and we all played sports. So for me, football and wrestling were two sports that I grew up playing. So as a byproduct of that, I was always in shape and fit. Because of how much, how many activities I was doing as a kid. Fast forward to 2009, I became certified as a personal trainer, started taking on clients. And here I was, someone who had never been overweight a day in my life, trying to help people who were overweight pretty much every day of their life. And there was an obvious disconnect because in my mind at that time, it was so easy. It's so easy, you guys. You just put down the junk food, you go to the gym, like you just stay disciplined, like, and it's not that hard. You just do it, right? Because for me, it was easy. And I had a client who was my brother-in-law at the time who told me, "No, Drew, you don't understand how hard it is for me or for people like me, because for you, it's always been easy." And when he said that, I kind of took that to heart. I was like, you know, you're right. I don't understand why it's so hard for people. It seems so simple in my mind. Like, you just do it, right? You just be disciplined. And then I was going down this rabbit hole of like, okay, what can I do to gain a better understanding? And for whatever reason, this idea of doing Fit to Fat Fit popped in my head. And it was like this light bulb went off and I'm like, oh shoot, I think I'm actually going to do this experiment. And so I decided to start a website, start a YouTube channel. I decided to let myself go for 6 months, no exercise. I ate a standard American diet of highly processed but delicious junk food and gained 75 pounds of pure fat in 6 months and then ended up losing it in the next 6 months. And that's why it's called Fit to Fat to Fit. So that's kind of the genesis of my story.
That's one heck of a dedication story. I'll tell you that. That is going above and beyond. But I really respect that you recognize that there was a disconnect there with your clients. And then, but to put yourself through that purposefully, that's a very unique situation.
Very similar kind of way, I let myself go right after high school and college and right, you know, job full time, sedentary, yep. Right? Boredom eating, all that good stuff. I must have been in my mid to late 30s when I realized like, I'm miserable. This sucks. And that's, you know, back to fitness and eating a little bit better. I'm still not great with the food, but how did your journey through that process? I mean, we can see how it affected you physically. How did it affect you mentally?
Yeah, that was the hardest part and the biggest surprise of doing Fit to Fat to Fit was how much of it was more mental and emotional than just physical. Like physically, I was pretty prepared for the increase in fat mass on my body. Yeah, I think I started at 8.5% body fat and got all the way up to 32% body fat by the end of it. But there were still some surprises along the way physically, but like, here's the biggest problem I had. I had a huge identity crisis as I gained the weight because in my mind, my body image was my self image. And so when I became overweight for the first time, I kind of freaked out, and which led to this identity crisis where I felt so uncomfortable being overweight for the first time in my life. I wanted to go up to strangers out in public and explain to them that I wasn't really overweight, that this is just an experiment and that they should go to my website so that they don't think I'm this overweight person, because I had built up an identity of Drew the fit guy my entire life. it was very, very uncomfortable. And I was very self-conscious as I gained the weight that first time in 2011. But it was very humbling. And it taught me a lot about the mental and emotional side of transformation. And, you know, it was very, very uncomfortable to take my shirt off out in public. I will say I did enjoy the food. The food actually does taste really, really good, but it does not make you feel good. And this is the problem that we have here in America, is we have all this highly processed junk food that is very cheap and affordable, right, for the majority of people. It's very convenient, and we're a society of convenience. And it's designed to be hyper-palatable and addictive. Like these foods that are, you know, marketed to us, like, you know, for me, my jam was Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I could eat that twice a day, be totally fine and happy. Sugary cereals, sugary sodas, juices, granola bars, chips, cookies, crackers, Hot Pockets, Top Ramen, SpaghettiOs, mac and cheese, like all the delicious cheap processed food we have here in America, is like we have an abundance of it. So it really taught me a lot about why people gravitate towards that food versus real food. Also, the other biggest lesson I would say I learned is that when I got off that food and started eating real whole food again, it sucked. Like for a good 2 weeks, it was miserable. Like my taste buds had changed and gotten adapted to the hyper palatable processed foods. And my body didn't feel good right away. It was almost like my body was going through withdrawal symptoms of the high that it got from those delicious junk foods for 6 months straight. And it taught me a lot of empathy, to be totally honest with you guys. I could better empathize and understand why people get stuck in those vicious cycles of eating this food. And the emotional connection to food, you guys, is way more powerful than I thought. So at the end of the day, after being humbled and going through this whole experience, I can honestly say I have so much empathy for people who get stuck, who struggle with weight loss and body image issues. And that's kind of the message that I want to bring back into the fitness industry after having done this journey twice now, is the importance of empathy in our industry.
Yeah, that's an incredible point. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious. You've experienced it, and you did it for a reason, right? I think if I understood correctly, you did it at first to kind of help your brother-in-law, who was a client, through his process. So when you gained that first 60 pounds, did you lose it with him?
So no, that was kind of the setup of the TV show. So my first initial journey was just doing it by myself. I actually stopped taking on clients, which sounds kind of stupid, but it's because I knew if I was in the gym training clients, I would be tempted to work out. And so to get rid of that temptation, I had to like be completely out of the gym. I stopped taking on clients at that time. But my hope was to motivate people like my brother-in-law in a backwards sort of way, which did come to fruition. Like a lot of people, as I lost the weight and the story went viral, right? Like I went on a bunch of TV shows like Dr. Oz and Jay Leno and Good Morning America. A bunch of people were motivated by what I was doing. And I can honestly say it inspired a lot of people. And that's where like the book deal happened and the TV show where we had two seasons of Fit to Fat to Fit air, and which did inspire a lot of people. So that part came to fruition, at least at the very end.
I'm curious, Drew. So tell us, you said that you had never, before this journey, you had never been heavy before, right? What was your diet like, as in before you went through this process? Did you have to work really hard at staying athletic and in shape? Or is it something where, you know, there are a good number of people out there who are genetically gifted, and based on age and your genetics and the composition of what your lifestyle is, that you're able to maintain something relatively easy with your physique and with your health? Were you more coasting in that space before this all happened? Or was it something that you were really having to work for with your nutrition and your training combo?
That's a good question. I would say it's a little bit of both, because yes, genetically I am blessed. I am gifted. That doesn't mean I don't work hard. I had to work hard to get to that level, but I started at a very young age. So it became a part of me at a very young age. And it just kind of stuck with me throughout my, you know, elementary school, middle school, and high school years. That level of like output and activity level just kind of made, and it was something that I actually liked to do. So yes, genetically, I did kind of have good genetics, which enabled me to maintain my physique. But you could see from my journey that, because a lot of people thought I wasn't even going to be able to get fat. Like people were like, oh, your genetics, like you're not even going to be able to gain anything. And so like they saw me gain 75 pounds of pure fat.
Yeah.
Bulky, yeah. Like bodybuilder would. This is just pure fat. So I do have the genetic capacity to be obese as well if I let myself go down that path. But it does take discipline and hard work. But yes, I would say that for me, yes, genetically, like it maybe my genetics are geared more towards being able to like maintain, because like I was able to lose the weight in 6 months, right?
Going into calorie deficit, right, that has a whole nother set of implications. I mean, you have the immediate effect on your body in terms of the fat loss, but you've got the mental aspect of that as well. I'll never forget, this was maybe what, 3 years ago, Kim, when you and I first started training together, she made some changes to my diet that put me into a calorie deficit. I was only getting about, I think it was about 6 ounces of protein, a cup of green veggies, and a couple of ounces of healthy fats, right? And I mean, I was probably 20% body fat at the time, trying to get to, you know, 10. It takes a toll, and it's extremely hard if you're not used to doing that to stay motivated and dedicated to it. How do you coach your clients and just people in general through the process of that?
That's a really good question. And my evolution of how I train clients has changed over the years from back in 2011, because my perspective has shifted ever since I did this experience in 2011, and then doing it again a second time as a 40-year-old in 2020. And then also doing a lot of inner work on myself. Like, I've hit my rock bottom. I went through a divorce after 10 years of marriage. I left my religion after being in that religion for 34 years of my life. Like there was some rock bottom moments that caused me to go down this path of self-discovery and healing, which all kind of like factored into how I show up as a trainer, which has totally shifted my approach and how I help my clients. So I would say nowadays, after having done this, there's a lot more focus on the mental and emotional side of transformation, because people go into physical transformation on a journey like this where they're like, okay, here's my macros, here's my calories, here's my workout. And if I just do this, then I will get this body. And then once I get this body, then I'll be happy. Then all my problems go away. And people go into it with that approach, but they don't realize that they are emotional creatures as humans. And so, and we're going to go deep here with the psychology of transformation. But what happens is, you know, as humans, we don't like to experience emotional pain. And a lot of us like to escape through substances, whether that's food, which is a very accessible drug that a lot of us can't escape through. And maybe from a very young age, food becomes our comfort, it becomes our safety. And we gravitate towards comfort foods, which make us feel happy and give us dopamine release that eases our pain temporarily. And then if we experience any kind of uncomfortable emotions in life, whether it's like a breakup or abuse or trauma or just emotional challenges through life, and you have been programming your brain over the years and decades to gravitate towards food or drugs or alcohol or whatever your vice is, and then all of a sudden, you're 30, 40 years old, and you're like, all right, I'm no more sugar this year, no more alcohol. I'm going to change my life. I'm just going to willpower my way through it. And most people, just like, you know, that try and get off drugs, willpower doesn't work for a lot of people. It'll get you so far, unless you're David Goggins, but most people struggle with just willpowering their way out of this lifestyle. And this is why transformation is way more mental and emotional for people. And so, like, I could give someone the best meal plans, I could give someone the best workout program and supplement protocol to help them achieve their physical transformation they're trying to achieve, but unless they understand why they are the way they are and why they're triggered and like where their emotional triggers stem from, this is why I'm such a huge proponent of doing the inner work rather than just trying to work out, you know, to solve all your problems. Because you're a human, you're an emotional creature, and understanding your habits and your triggers and why you reach for the cake when you're stressed out or overwhelmed, it's not going to make a difference if I just give you a diet to follow and trying to hit your macros, because that person is a human, they're not a robot. And when they're stressed out with kids and finances and like, you know, situations in life that cause this overwhelm, people tend to self-sabotage. And a lot of people self-sabotage through, you know, highly processed junk foods, because I'll be honest with you, it makes you feel better temporarily in the short term. But then it creates shame of like, man, why did I do that? I need to be more disciplined. I need to beat myself up more and hate myself more to be more disciplined so I don't make that mistake. And that's kind of what I'm trying to help people with. So what do I do to help people? I give them tools on the mental and emotional side with stress management specifically. So this is why I'm such a huge proponent of things like meditation, breathwork, journaling, gratitude, a daily gratitude practice, therapy, life coaching, getting out in nature. There's a lot of tools that I give people that have nothing to do with weight loss and everything to do with overcoming those mental and emotional hurdles, so that when it comes to the physical stuff, it becomes easier or more manageable because they're not coming from a triggered, overwhelmed state of mind, trying to just, you know, willpower their way out of this unhealthy lifestyle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Completely. I mean, it's one of those, and Sean and I have talked about this with some other, you know, elite athletes that we've talked to as well, on, you know, how to find that way to balance the mental aspect with the demand on the body, you know. And so I really applaud your efforts on taking that direction, because there are a lot of people out there who say that they address that portion of it, that there's a stress control factor that needs to be addressed, but they don't really know how to go about doing it. And it is different. The triggers for people are different based on that person, what their background is, you know. And I'm sure you've gone through this with your clients. What works for one person doesn't work for the next. For me, getting outside is a huge deal, but there's a lot of, you know, there are people that I've worked with who don't have the availability to do that, you know, just because their schedule is just so crazy. And so when you sit down with somebody and you have this conversation with them on the way to deal with the mental aspect of it and the psychotherapy function that has to be coordinated along with it, how do you go about figuring out what works for them?
Honestly, it's a lot of trial and error. Like, I would say, for the most part, you know, a lot of the tools that I've used that have worked for me tend to work great for some people. But I think it's just like any great trainer or coach has a bunch of different tools to offer their clients, and giving those tools to add to that person's arsenal or tool belts to help them to figure out what works for them. And so, you know, when I work with someone, I kind of meet them where they're at. Like, if they have never meditated, I'm not going to give them like a 30-minute meditation practice to start on day one. It might start with something simple. Like, for example, instead of a meditation, it might be a sit still challenge. And you would be surprised at how many adults here in America struggle to sit still without moving a muscle for just even like 30 seconds. I try and start at 5 minutes for people, and it's funny how many adults just can't sit still. Like, they need to scratch an itch. They need to adjust. They can't. And just even that practice alone, just being still, and I think is what we struggle with, of just, because in stillness, there's clarity of like really listening to yourself and figure out, you know, why do I do these things? Why do I keep self-sabotaging? Why am I triggered by my kid doing this or my spouse doing that? Like, why does this cause me so much stress and overwhelm? And the more you make time to contemplate these things, the more power you have in choosing your response. There's a good quote by Viktor Frankl who said, between stimulus and response, there's power. And what he means by that is, anytime you're stimulated or there's a trigger in your life, the more space you create between that stimulus or trigger and how you respond, the more power you have to choose your response. Most people are just triggered, and then they have a built-in programmed reaction that is in the subconscious mind that they don't even think about doing what they do or why they're doing it. It's just been programmed over the years and decades to be like, trigger, reaction. And then they think about it afterwards, like, man, why did I do that? And so what we're trying to do is create space between stimulus and response. And the more space you have, the more power you have to choose. And so we kind of go through the list of tools that I just mentioned. Breathwork is a great one. Just taking like 3 to 5 deep breaths before you let that emotion come out the way you've been programmed. You know, getting outside in nature is another great opportunity, or just writing down your thoughts or feelings really quick before you respond, talking to a friend, you know, like I said, meditation and breath work or a gratitude practice or positive affirmations are also tools that I would throw in there. And this is why I think a lot of people should try things like therapy or life coaching as well, because they kind of help you become the observer of your thoughts rather than always being attached to your thoughts. So it does take trial and error for some people. And this is honestly harder work than it is to give people a workout program. Like, most people can do a workout program, but if it comes to facing their inner demons and dealing with their emotions, a lot of people are scared to do that because they're afraid to face themselves and like go deep to figure out, yes, I have to admit that this trauma that I had is affecting me in this way. And but that's where the healing process starts to happen.
There's a lot of good advice in there. I think what you're at the core of what you're kind of describing, it's, you know, helping people regain control over their thoughts and their decisions, right? Which is going to lead to lifestyle change. It's going to lead to nutrition change.
Yeah.
It's going to lead to changes in their routines and training. you get somebody in the right mental space, and then you help them understand what it is that they need to eat and why. And then that leaves you with kind of the training regimen. Getting them in the right headspace, giving them a nutrition plan that works for them. And then take me through kind of what you do with folks from a training perspective to help them tear down the muscle or tear down and rebuild.
So I'll kind of use what I, the method I use to what I use to get back to fit, right? So after the first journey I did in 2011, I gained 76 pounds. And then the second time I did it in 2020, I gained 62 pounds. And so what I did for exercise, actually in the beginning, is a lot of stretching and core workouts with just walking. Like, I didn't feel the need to rush back into the gym to start doing heavy deadlifts and heavy squats like right away, because when you're sedentary and you're a couch potato, the last thing you want to do is get injured in your first 30 days, right? So focusing on core strength, stretching, you know, a lot of those, like sitting down all day, you guys know, is horrible for your back, for your hip flexors, your hamstrings. Like, you just moving, functional movements and stretching and walking and doing these simple core exercises as a base. I did that for maybe 2 to 4 weeks in the beginning, and then changed my diet, which obviously reduced inflammation and just makes it a little bit easier to move your body when you're eating real whole foods. Your sleep tends to be better. Your digestion tends to be better. You have more energy throughout the day. So I would start there. But then from there, I actually, the next phase would be body weight workouts. So just very simple movements, functional movements, things like push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, squats, lunges, you know, very basic movements. It's nothing too hardcore. But just, you know, getting those muscles activated and warmed up, if you will, for the next 2 to 4 weeks for that next phase. And then from there, I started adding, you know, weights. And I would tend to do supersets, which kind of give you the benefits of both, you know, resistance training plus cardio. And that's kind of the method that I think works for a lot of people that are pressed for time is, you know, you'll do like one day is like a legs and shoulders. So you'll do a set of squats and you'll do a set of military press and you'll do a set of lunges and a set of side raises, right? Whatever the movements are, but there's no breaks in between. So your heart rate's kind of elevated throughout the entire workout. So I would do that about 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then Tuesdays, Thursdays were a mix of different types of cardio. So sometimes it would be long, slow distance, maybe zone 2 type of cardio. And then the other day would be HIIT cardio training. So like 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off for 20 to 30 minutes. And then I'd mix in some core strength. And then honestly, Saturday and Sundays were my off days. So I'd play with my kids, get out in nature if I could, go swimming, go biking, whatever it was, you know, just staying active. And honestly, that was the formula I used for both journeys, honestly, was like 5 workouts per week, maybe 40, 45 minutes a day for my workouts. And those are the methods I used for me. And it tends to work for a lot of people when they're just getting started, you know.
So first of all, I think that's a lot of good advice. And frankly, I'm not in terrible shape right now. And that still is a lot of what I do, right? I mean, even today, you know, for me, today was shoulders and arms was my mix today. But, you know, still mixing in a lot of body weight stuff, intervals, you know, HIIT intervals for 30 seconds or a minute in between sets. How long, what was the duration from the time that you decided, all right, I've put on enough weight, now I'm going to drop it and get back to fit? What was the duration of that?
So the first journey in 2011, I gained weight for 6 months and then I lost the weight in 6 months. And that was kind of the goal from the beginning, was to, like, you know, gain for 6 months and then lose for 6 months and hopefully it would all end well. Luckily it did, but I'll be honest with you. I had doubts. I was scared. There was times where I didn't lose any weight during the weeks. Some weeks I gained weight, right? So it's not, weight loss isn't linear, as we all know, but some people like to think it is. Even me as a trainer, I'm like, this should be working. I calculated everything and it's still not working. And then the second journey, 4 months of gaining, 4 months of losing, and same results. But I had a different approach. Like, as I was older, I used more of a keto intermittent fasting method, which tended to work better for my body at that age. And back in 2011, keto wasn't really mainstream or intermittent fasting wasn't that popular. It was more so like the approach you use, which is 5-6 small meals per day every 2 or 3 hours. That was kind of like the method that was used back then in the fitness industry. And both work. Like, both can work. Like, there's not one that's better, but I felt like at where I was at that stage, I used more of like that approach, the more of like a biohacking approach. So
did you do any testing of your blood work before you started it and then when you were gaining weight? Because I bet that would be fascinating to look at all the individual pieces of it and see how the effects took place.
Yeah. Oh man, it was scary at sometimes. I remember my first journey, this is back in 2011. I did have a doctor monitor me. I didn't get any baseline blood work, unfortunately, but I do remember my blood pressure got up to 167 over 113 at its highest. That was scary. And when I was on Dr. Oz, he said that my liver enzymes were like, I was getting closer to cirrhosis if I continued down that path. I also developed a non-alcoholic fatty liver during my first journey because I didn't drink alcohol at that time, just a lot of sugary soda. And my testosterone dropped to the low 200s as a 31-year-old, right, which is not good. And then on my second journey during in 2020, I had a lot more access to doctors and, you know, testing, and I did it a lot during that journey. And my triglycerides were at the highest. They got up to the mid 500s, which was scary. That's when I was doing a vegetarian type of diet to show people that just because you're a vegetarian doesn't mean you're necessarily healthier. And so my triglycerides during that vegetarian experiment got up to like 4 or 530 or something like that.
Interesting.
So, very scary.
Yeah, it is. But fascinating, because you have all this data that you got back through this that you can then share with your clients to say, you know, that there's so much more that goes into what constitutes your health than one piece of the puzzle, right? There's all these other factors. And granted, you know, there's stress levels and environmental things that can happen that can influence that. But when you are really focused on the diet, like you did in your experiment, it makes some obvious assumptions that, you know, all these individual pieces are affected by diet. It's not just, and I'm sure, how was your mood affected as well?
That was the hard part. It's like, and this is what I try to paint a picture for people. Like, just because you eat this unhealthy food doesn't just make you gain weight. If that's all it did, that wouldn't be that bad actually. But what it does is it changes you at the core, because the number one thing that is affected as you live this sedentary lifestyle full of junk food is your sleep is affected. And when your sleep is off, your hormones are off. And when your hormones are off, it's hard to show up as your best self. Like, your ability to handle stress is severely diminished when your cortisol is elevated all day long. You didn't sleep well throughout the night, right? You didn't have a lot of like your REM sleep, and you wake up kind of feeling sluggish and brain foggy, and you're very lethargic from eating this food constantly. These blood sugar spikes from all the junk food, and then crash, and then spike again, crash, and you're exhausted all day long. So you're taking stimulants, and which, like I said, elevate your cortisol throughout the day, and then it's hard to fall asleep. And then you do that day after day, week after week, month after month. It affects you, whether you're a spouse, a father, a mother, an employee, like showing up in this world, it affects you at the core of who you truly are. And that's what I try to show people, is like, yes, you are more moody, you are more cranky, you're not sleeping well through the night, your libido tanks and takes a hit. And yeah, you're not the nicest person when you're not sleeping well. Like, ask any parent of a newborn baby, like, you're constantly just in survival mode. That's what it's kind of like when you treat your body like this. And some people live this way for years or decades, and they don't know that they can actually feel better. They don't know they kind of forget what it feels like to be healthy. And that kind of becomes their norm, is this unhealthy state physically, mentally. And that's the thing I also wanted to tell people, like, if you want better mental health, you have to take care of your physical health. You don't need to be 5% body fat. You don't need to become a like Iron Man triathlete. Just simple four pillars for me are like quality sleep, 7 to 8 hours of quality sleep, stress management of some type, whatever works for you, whether that's meditation or religion or getting out in nature, you know, breath work, journaling, whatever works for you. And then nutrition, just eat real whole food. I really don't care which diet you follow. Eat lots of protein, lots of fiber, and eat real whole food as much as you can. And then movement, exercise. It doesn't have to be the gym. It can be anything that's fun for you. Dancing, swimming, biking, hiking, rucking, like any kind of movement is going to be great for your physical health and your mental health. And like, at the end of the day, if you do those four things, I really don't care what body fat percentage you have. I don't care how muscular you are, because at the end of the day, none of that matters, you know, when it comes to your overall health. If you're taking care of those four pillars, for the most part, as a byproduct, you'll probably be healthier and, you know, more lean if you're doing those things. And I don't know, sometimes we kind of overcomplicate it for people. And I think as humans, as emotional creatures, our physical transformation journey is closely tied to our mental and emotional state of minds. And if we're not in a good place mentally and emotionally, it's really hard to show up and do the physical things. And this is why I'm such a big proponent of working in and not just working out.
Yeah, I love that. And it's one of the, you know, in today's society, doctors, you know, they get a lot of patients who are asking for a Band-Aid for this. And that's where these prescriptions come in. And you know, you mentioned stimulants and all of these prescriptions and all of these stimulants that people end up taking to try to help solve the problem. It has a direct impact on our ability to produce dopamine naturally. You know, I mean, it's just at the end of the cycle, there's just a lot more things that end up getting broken, but people don't realize that when they're going in, you know, they don't have an hour to spend chatting with a doctor, you know, to figure out all the details. And a lot of those doctors that take the time to do that, they're few and far between.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of over-medicating away your problems. I think a lot can be handled through the things that Drew's been outlining. Having an outlet to address the mental component, proper nutrition, good sleep, being active, right? That goes a long way. So I really do appreciate that kind of point of view, and putting them into those four pillars that's not something I don't think any of our other guests have done. That should resonate well with people. It's very simple and easy to understand.
Yeah. So there's something else I'd like to highlight, if you don't mind. Something that Drew said, Sean, a little bit earlier that I think is really key to a lot of these things is that, you know, you mentioned, Drew, on being able to find a life coach or a therapist to talk to. And it used to be, and I am totally guilty. I am one of these people, you know, I used to really believe that that was only for the extreme situation, you know, and that was only if you had problems. Yeah. And, you know, and it was like, it was almost taboo, you know, it was almost one of those things that was like, ooh, you must have a lot of problems if you're going to this, you know. And more and more, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts that are out there from different components, different types of people and different career paths and different levels of education. And it is becoming so much more broadly accepted and encouraged that the healthy person, the person, and even relationships, you know, for couples therapy as well, the people who are healthy and not having problems it's a good thing to go to these people. The people who are having a wonderful life, when everything is going great in your life, it's still a good place to be to keep you in check. To have another pair of eyes or to have another voice of reason to say and ask the questions that maybe you by yourself aren't thinking of as you go through the process.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. I think, you know, my generation, you know, our generation versus our parents' generation, we have access to more tools like this that are becoming more mainstream. And like, I think my therapist actually said this. She's like, people that are in therapy because the people in their lives that didn't go to therapy. So like our parents or grandparents or teachers or siblings or coaches, like we're in therapy because they didn't go to therapy. And so now this is what it's about. Like I'm a dad, I have two daughters. It's very important for me to work through that stuff because there's a good quote I love and it goes, if you don't heal what hurts you, you're going to bleed on those who didn't cut you. And so what it means to me is like, if I don't heal my past traumas and wounds, I'm going to pass that on unconsciously to my kids, my grandkids, those same patterns, those same beliefs that are, you know, that are broken in a sense that have made me or caused us a lot of our issues. If we don't heal that, we're just going to continue to pass that on to the people who are innocent in our lives that don't deserve to like, so that's why for me, I'm like, I have to like do the work on myself so that my daughters don't have to go through those same broken patterns of self-hate and the same things that I went through. And that's kind of like, what's my motivation to do the inner work. And yeah, I think, you know, it is hard. It's uncomfortable to get out there and be vulnerable because no one really taught us how to do that in a healthy way. And it's not our parents' fault. They didn't know any better. They didn't have access to this. They didn't, you know, it wasn't mainstream. And now it's becoming more mainstream. And now our generation has an opportunity to break that cycle, if you will, so that the next generation, you know, doesn't have to suffer as much as we did in that sense. And so that's why for me, doing the work is super important. Right? But you bring up a good point. It does take that first initial step of getting out of your comfort zone and being open to new methods that, you know, maybe you thought were woo-woo or a little bit weird before. But now I think a lot of people are like, yeah, I know a lot of people go to therapy. I know a lot of people that meditate. I know a lot of people that do breath work. And it's like, oh, okay, these people are doing it. Maybe I could step out of my comfort zone and do it too. So
I was just actually talking to somebody yesterday who was saying, you know, that they're a young couple who's really new to dating each other. They've been with each other for like 3 months, I would say. And they both decided to start seeing a therapist right in the very beginning of their relationship to learn how to communicate, to make sure that they avoid the crap you know, as they develop their relationship, things that build up and, you know, the bad things that build up and things. And I was like, you know, I would have never thought of doing that, you know, but it's an interesting concept. It's a really great idea that you're trying to get ahead of it and not wait until a whole bunch of things are broken. So there's a lot of reasons to go that are worthwhile. So I appreciate you bringing that up earlier on in the call.
Yeah, I've long thought a lot of different gyms over the years, a lot of different trainers, and I've long thought that there should be an element of trainer certification that includes the mental health aspect. Is like it or not, right? You're going to be working with a client generally for about an hour. They're going to be unloading on you, and you know you're going to have to absorb that. And they're looking for you to feed something back, right? Whether that's part of the job description or not, it just naturally happens. I've seen it thousands and thousands of times. I wonder if there is anybody out there taking a good hard look at that.
Yeah, I think there might be. I think, you know, I have created just recently a new kind of approach or brand, if you will, called Conscious Fitness. And this is kind of what I do more so now, where it's, is it an actual certification? Not yet, but it's basically taking these tools and methods that I've used on the mental and emotional side. So right now I guide people through breathwork sessions. I'm a breathwork practitioner on top of helping people with their diet and exercise. But I found that giving people tools on the mental and emotional side, like breathwork, for example, you know, meditation, gratitude, journaling, these types of tools have been very, very helpful and powerful in helping people deal with their traumas or their triggers to understand themselves on a deeper level. So that when I give them the meal plans and the workouts, they're entering that phase with a more clear mind and not as triggered and overwhelmed. And I think there does need to be some kind of training on that side, because, and even, I would say this even for doctors, doctors or any kind of coaches that's helping humans deal with like hard things, you're gonna have to deal with that person's traumas and triggers. Like if they come to your training session and they just got into a fight with their spouse and they're struggling financially, or they're going through a divorce or something, like it's not that easy to show up and just beat yourself down by doing a hard workout that's gonna make you puke when you're already on the verge of crying and overwhelmed of like life situations. Cause at the end of the day, life is more like being a mom, being a dad, you know, is more important sometimes in the moment than doing a really hard workout, which yes, sometimes serves a purpose in that moment, but other times people just need a hug. They need to be seen. They need to be heard and understood. They're human. And like that aspect is kind of lost in the fitness industry. It's like, hey, man up, dude, like you're here to work. I'm not here to give you a hug, you know? But what I do with Conscious Fitness tries to take a different approach of teaching people the importance of self-love, teaching them how to become more self-aware. And I think awareness, self-awareness is something that is very overlooked. And, you know, the more aware you are of something, the more in control you are of it. The less aware you are of it, the more it's in control of you. And this is why self-awareness is super important. It's an important practice to learn of like, oh, this is why I do what I do. This is why I'm reacting this way. Oh, okay. Next time I'm going to like make sure and observe that and not attach my emotions to it and just notice that it's happening. And then I'll be able to create space, like I talked about, between stimulus and reaction. And that's kind of the goal of what I do with Conscious Fitness. So we'll see where this goes. Maybe there's an opportunity there, but you bring up a good point.
I think it sounds incredible. I'm anxious to see what you do with it. Kim, as Drew's kind of explained his thoughts and his approach to this, you know, I've been asking myself, all right, do I do that? You talk about breath work, talk about stretching, talk about, you know, just, you know, getting your body prepared to transform. For the most part, I think I can say, yes, I do a lot of that stuff, but it's derived from years and years and years of martial arts, where you practice meditation and you practice stretching. And so these things are just inherent in my daily life. And Kim's a practitioner in different martial arts as well. And I'm
at the end of the day, it's like most everything else where you have to practice it and drill it over and over and over. And that includes breath work, and it includes making yourself conscious, you know, to Drew's point earlier, making yourself aware of how you're reacting and how you're handling things. I think the combination of sports and martial arts that I've done, they've all had a piece of that. They've all had a piece of either stretching and breathing components where, you know, that relates to being able to feel. And this is one of the things that I've been able to incorporate into bodybuilding. It's very much a mind-muscle connection. Can you make that mind-muscle connection? Can you think through what you're doing? Can you feel your breathing as you're doing this movement? Yoga has a lot to do with that as well. Martial arts is very much about breathing at the right time and remaining calm in an urgent situation, which is what we do in everyday life, which is one of the reasons I love it. I'm a huge fan, especially for children, of getting into sports of some kind to be able to help process that, because how you can get out there and manage wins, losses, breathing through injuries or problems, that is just the best preparation you can get for the daily life later on.
Drew, we're coming close to the end of our time. So what I'd really like to do is leave it with any last bits of advice that you have for listeners, and then maybe tell people how to get in touch with you if they want to understand a little bit more how to go from fat to fit.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate that. The one thing I'll say really quick, just to sum everything up that I've talked about, obviously, I think people are hopefully noticed that this approach is different. You know, I try and lead with empathy. My journey has been one from self-hate my entire life, using that as motivation to some really hard things. And it's worked to push me through some like hard wrestling practices and football practices and beating myself up to better myself. But then that approach didn't work anymore. And it just left me broken and hating myself even more. And I got out of that eventually and started to develop self-love. And I want to talk to people really quick about the importance of self-love and a health and fitness journey, because a lot of people think, okay, one day when I get this body, then I'll love myself. Once everything's perfect, then I'll love myself. The problem with that is that the journey sucks because it's full of self-hate and doubt and self-sabotage and self-loathing and wishing you were different. What I try and do with conscious fitness is teach people that they're lovable now, that you can learn to love yourself as you are and still want to improve your situation, and using self-love as a motivating tool to get you to do the hard things that are required to give you the change that you're seeking in your life that you're worthy of. And so a lot of people think, oh, if I love myself, then I'll just Netflix and chill and eat ice cream all day. That's not true self-love. There's a time and place for that on your self-love journey. But self-love is realizing that you are worthy of good physical health, good mental health, good spiritual health.
Drew, your approach, the fit to fat to fit, I think it's incredibly inspirational. I think it connects with a ton of people. I'm really curious to see what you do with conscious fitness. This all sounds really fantastic. So I want to thank you very much for talking with us today, sharing your story yet again. I know you've been through this a number of times, so we really appreciate that. Join us again next time for the Inspired Fitness Podcast. Until then, we wish you a healthy mind, a healthy body, and healthy habits. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Fitness, leading you to a healthy mind, healthy body, and healthy habits. To stay inspired, visit us at inspiredfitness.net. That's INSPIRD.net. Until next time, stay inspired.